Look, we've got Josh Grice here. I'd love to just introduce our speaker for tonight. Josh is one of the directors of Training Week, and there's a number of people who from church who know Josh, and we have the privilege of hearing from him. Josh has got an amazing mind, and I love the way he thinks, and so we're going to hear a little bit different tonight, but some great thoughts from Josh. So can we give him a clap and welcome Josh tonight?
Hey everyone, so as Sam said, my name is Josh. For those of you who haven't met me, which is probably most of you, it's great to see so many faces in the room. I met Sam, as he mentioned, leading on some camps together to encourage and inspire young people in their faith. And when he mentioned the idea of food for thought, that sounded like an absolute dream to me. I love food, and I love thinking about the deep questions in life. That we don't always get time to think about. So it's a pleasure and a privilege to be here with you guys. A little bit more about me. I am an economist by training. I'm doing my honours year at the moment at uni. I've done a few work experiences across government policy and the private sector. I was down in Sydney interning at the Reserve Bank over summer, so interest rates are my fault. I'm very sorry about that. Everyone is feeling the pain at the moment. But really, I got into economics because I was interested in people, and how they think and make decisions and how that shapes the world, how the world works. My greatest loves outside of Jesus are my beautiful wife, Emma, who couldn't be here tonight, sadly, and all things sport. Any sports people in the room? Yep, a few of us, cool, awesome. I particularly love rugby, volleyball, cricket, and this new sport called spikeball. Has anyone heard of spikeball? Yeah, a few people? Okay, so I love that. It's this weird little trampoline thing. It's kind of maybe more like beach volleyball than anything else. Hit the ball on it. So that's my favorite sport at the moment. But I'm a pretty competitive guy in general. And I love all sports, but so much so that I took games probably a little bit too seriously as a kid. Think about Easter egg hunts. They were pretty brutal in my family. I was a kid at youth group who was always trying to figure out how to bend the rules as far as I possibly could without getting caught in every game. So not cheating, just strategy. Finding loopholes where I could. If there's any lawyers in the room, probably know what I'm talking about. No, I'm just kidding. But a year or two ago, Emma and I, my now wife, played a game of hide and seek in a friend's house in Sydney, and I was so competitive that I actually hid on their roof of the house, which I never got caught, so it worked pretty well in the game, not so much for my relationship. I think Emma wasn't super impressed with that. But the reason I share that is it's a little bit related to what I'm keen to share with you guys about tonight in the few short minutes that we have together, which is really around this question of how do we make sense of what some philosophers have called the hiddenness of God. The idea that there isn't really any good evidence that God is real, and if our eternity really rides on the decision that we make about him, isn't it a bit unfair that he doesn't make his existence more believable? If God really is omnipotent, why doesn't he tear open the sky in some sort of cosmic peekaboo? Why doesn't he speak to us directly, maybe leave a made by God logo on every atom? Even for Christians, I hear lots of people, and this has been part of my experience, experiencing these dark nights of the soul, where even as life sort of seems to be falling apart around us, heaven can seem strangely silent, as if our prayers are posted to a non-existent address. In Psalm 10, King David even gives voice to the cry of many biblical figures when he asks, "Why, Lord, do you stand far off? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble?" And so whether you're sort of exploring the God question for the first time with us tonight, I'm so glad you're here, or whether you've called yourself a Christian for years, we want to think about, why does it sometimes feel like God is playing hide and seek? Isn't this some sort of strong evidence that God either isn't there, or he doesn't really care? So I want to start with that doubt, with that sort of potential objection to the Christian story. And what I want to end with is an invitation for everyone, no matter where you're at. But in the middle, I just want to give you two or three thoughts to chew on, pun intended, that have helped me in kind of wrestling with this question. Because when I started considering life's deepest questions for myself back in high school, this was one of my biggest barriers to following Jesus. And even as a Christian for many years, it's remained one of my bigger discomforts. Why isn't God more obvious? If you're interested in more resources on this after tonight, there's a couple of great videos that have come out recently on a YouTube channel called Questioning Christianity that has lots of answers to life's deep questions like this from a Christian perspective. And there's both a short one and then a longer one in detail with some philosophers if you're interested in that. But in the time that we have, and we'll sort of split this into two segments, let me just give you three ways that I think different scenes of the Christian story, sort of the big overarching narrative of the Bible and what Christians believe, speak to this question, and then we'll have some time for questions and discussion kind of along the way as well, hopefully. So number one, first way that a scene of the Christian story kind of speaks to this question, the hiddenness of God, I want to say that the Christian story, I'm going to go to this slide. Where should I point this with this guy? Up the back? Oh, there we go. We'll get there. Awesome. The Christian story affirms the assumption that we should expect God to reveal himself. And that might be an assumption that's actually more controversial than you think. That might seem obvious to you, but many religions, and particularly famous deists, we would say, like Einstein or some of the American founding fathers, would deny this. They'd instead believe in some sort of supernatural power who got things started, but who kind of remains distant and indifferent to the things of our world and doesn't reveal himself or try and be involved in our lives, the daily goings-on of our world in any way. By contrast, the good news of the Christian story is that the being that we call God is the greatest imaginable person. He's eternal, all-powerful, morally perfect, and lacking nothing. So he didn't create the world out of a lack of anything, out of a need for us or a random whim, but like two human parents who choose to have a child, in some sense, God brought life into the world as an overflow of the love and joy that already existed in the Trinity. And so we were made intentionally and not accidentally in God's image for relationship with him and with each other and with the rest of creation. And so we were created for good in the beginning. In the early chapters of Genesis, the first book in the Bible, it speaks of God walking with humans in the garden paradise that represented this overlap between heaven and earth, between God's space and our space. And in the Bible's last book, Revelation, we see similar imagery of the glorious future that awaits all who trust in Jesus and who are reconciled through him, together enjoying relationship with God forever, face to face in an even better restored garden city. And so both in the opening and in the closing scenes of the Christian story, it's abundantly clear that divine hiddenness, this sense of God's absence at times, wasn't necessarily a part of God's original design, and it certainly won't be a part of his ultimate endgame. So why isn't that our experience now then, in the middle, at this point in human history, at this point in redemptive history? And that kind of brings us to my second point. So there's some good news at the start. This isn't necessarily the way that we were created. This is not necessarily what it's going to be like in the end, according to the Christian story. But what about what's going on now? Well, my second point, or my second sort of scene in the Christian story that speaks this, is this sense that in some way we've become damaged by evil. And so according to the Christian story, what the Bible would call sin, our rebellion against God, has had catastrophic consequences. Think about, if you've read this story in the Garden of Eden, it's actually humanity who starts hiding from God out of guilt and shame behind fig leaves before God ever hides from us. And you can think this through from different perspectives, right? From God's perspective, God is holy. That means he's sort of other. He is so pure and morally perfect that he cannot tolerate our imperfection, our sin, our rebellion in his presence. Just as shadows are sort of vanquished instantly when you turn on a light, can feel the light shining pretty brightly here. There's some sort of relational distance now between us and God, this side of the fall, what Christians call the fall, our rebellion against God, not designed to hurt us, but actually to protect us from the consuming fire of God's justice until we come to Jesus to be forgiven and washed clean, to be reconciled and to be redeemed. Meanwhile, on the other hand, from our perspective, I think that we're so often blind of eye and deaf of ear and hard of heart. And so our rejection of God ultimately as Father, our rebellion against him as King, kind of clouds our ability to notice and to experience him in the way that we should. And given our typical human stubbornness, I don't think it's necessarily obvious that a greater revelation of God, God revealing himself in more dramatic or explicit ways, would necessarily achieve God's goals of having greater restored relationship with people. And that might seem counterintuitive to you, but if you look at stories in the Bible, we need to look only as far as Israel, the nation of Israel in the Old Testament, who consistently turned away from God despite the many miracles that they witnessed in front of their eyes. Think of the way they led out of Egypt, these crazy, miraculous ways that God has blessed them. And then Moses goes up Mount Sinai to get the law from God, and suddenly they're worshiping other gods again. Straight away, they've rebelled against him in idolatry. And there's lots of stories of this all throughout the Old Testament, even of people who saw such dramatic and undeniable signs of God's presence, consistently rejected at times relationship with him. Or you think about the Pharisees in Jesus' day, whose unwavering opposition to him and hardness of heart came in spite of public signs and wonders that he performed. And so in Romans 1, in a passage in the New Testament, the Bible makes this diagnosis explicit when it condemns people for so often suppressing even what they know to be the truth. And much of modern psychology would actually agree with this sort of diagnosis, right? Lots of research into areas like confirmation bias, motivated reasoning, and other such phenomena, suggesting that so often we actually decide first what we want to believe, and then we find reasons to justify it. Even though we love to think of ourselves as these pure rational agents who follow the evidence where it leads 100% of the time, so often at the end of the day, there's lots of research and lots of experiments that show that's so often not how we think. One resource on this by a secular non-Christian writer is called The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt. It's a good book if you're interested in more on that. These are the words of, a little bit old now, this is from 1997, but a very famous atheist philosopher at the time, Thomas Nagel. He said this. He said, "I want atheism," so the belief that there is no God, "to be true, and am made uneasy by the fact that some of the most intelligent and well-informed people I know are religious believers. It isn't just that I don't believe in God, and naturally that I hope I'm right in my belief. It's that I hope there is no God, and I don't want there to be a God. I don't want the universe to be like that." And there are plenty of other famous skeptics who would openly acknowledge that there's no amount of evidence that could convince them to believe in God. Even if they had a spectacular vision, they'd think the best explanation was probably that they had some sort of hallucination. And they would still reject God, even if he revealed himself undeniably. And so I'm not claiming that this is the conscious view of every atheist, of everyone who rejects God or who isn't a Christian. And I'm not wanting to cast aspersions at anyone's intentions in particular, but I think it's interesting for all of us to reflect candidly on where our own hearts are at and to sift our own motives when we think about approaching big worldview questions like this. And then the second sort of thing that I want to say under this broad point of the way that the world has been damaged by evil and the way that God might then interact with us at this point in redemptive history that might be different from his original design and different from his final endgame is that I would argue that even if we were able to rightly and objectively assess the revelation that God's given us 100% of the time, what if the type of presence of God that we desire, or that we at least claim that we would want, isn't actually the type of presence that we require? Maybe like Doctor Strange in the Marvel movies, if we've got any Avengers or Marvel fans in the room, God as an omniscient being, maybe he knows all the possible futures that might result from the complex web and interaction of free creaturely decisions that we might make. And maybe he uses that information to carefully choose when and how to reveal himself in order to bring about his ultimate endgame, right? Which I would summarize in at least two things. One, that we would form deep and meaningful relationships with God and with others. And secondly, that we would become heavenly beings, right? More like Jesus, capable of ruling alongside Jesus as the gardeners and governors of his good creation, his new creation in the long run. That we would go through this process of moral maturity and growing to be wiser and more like him. And so I would argue that God, and we'll get to this sort of in my third point, which is probably be after the break and where I'll spend the most time, but I would argue that God has provided sufficient evidence to demonstrate his existence, right? To make plain who he is and how we can come to know him, but that he's withheld enough to prevent us from living by reason alone. And we see that in the way that Jesus describes his parables too, right? The stories he tells in the New Testament. as being only accessible to those who are seeking with an open mind and an open heart. When Jesus hung on a cross for us, when he died for our sins, he didn't do it merely to win our mental assent, right? He did it to win back sons and daughters into his loving family. And so I think God wants intimate relationship with us, not merely intellectual recognition at the end of the day. And I think we sometimes misjudge the human heart when we assume that a more obvious revelation of God would necessarily achieve that intimate relationship. In fact, I suspect that it could be counterproductive at times. And so let me give you just three illustrations. Number one, my relationship with Emma, my wife, who I mentioned before, is actually stronger, not weaker, for the fact that even when she can't see me right now, she can trust me. She can trust that I really am here speaking at Vicky Point, and that I'm not somewhere else cheating on her, for example, God forbid, right? The fact that she doesn't have to follow me around and see me face to face in the most explicit sense all the time to be able to trust me is actually a sign of strength in our relationship, not of weakness. Another sort of famous story is told by Soren Kierkegaard and is sort of famously echoed in plenty of movie manifestations, I'm sure, of the king who disguises himself as a humble commoner to romantically pursue a maiden, right? All so that she might not be swayed or overwhelmed by his status, but rather to choose him for not what he is, but who he is. And my third one would just be the simple analogy that a gentle whisper in the way that I speak causes us to lean in more intimately than an announcement that's shouted sort of generally from the rooftops. And so maybe those are just hints that rather than coercing and overwhelming us by the sheer intensity of his presence, God preserves both the freedom and the opportunity for trusting faith that's required for genuine, deep, and meaningful relationships. That we would learn to come to know God and to love God for the right reasons, not just because of what he is and his power and his status, but for who he is. And so many Christians would attest to how dark nights of the soul that I mentioned before, though painful at times, the sense of heaven's absence, even when it's needed most, eventually can give way to the dawn of a deeper faith and relationship with God that's stronger as a result. Whether that time helped to challenge and purify our expectations or to bring growth in our spiritual hunger and dependence on God or to refine and forge our character so that our weaknesses are exposed and so that we learn empathy in a way that we otherwise wouldn't have. God's hiddenness can mature us in a multitude of ways that might only become evident or clear in retrospect, in hindsight. For some, a longer journey coming to faith, not being overwhelmed by God's presence or being completely convinced immediately of who he is, but sort of coming to that over a process of time, maybe even seasons in their life of scathing criticism and opposition to the church and to God and to Christianity, could provide, like the Apostle Paul in the Bible, who had a dramatic conversion story and who certainly didn't buy the stocks of the early church early on. Maybe that provides necessary credibility, as it did for Paul, to then win others to Christ later in a way that's far more powerful in the ripple effect across history. And so I guess my point here is that just because we can't perceive God's reasons for sometimes not being as obvious as we might think he is, doesn't mean that he doesn't have them, right? We've speculated about a few of what those reasons might be, but even to the extent that we are left with some mystery, as we are in many areas of our faith and of dealing with these big questions, that doesn't mean that God couldn't have reasons for doing this. And so my third and maybe if it works, there we go. I didn't write it down, so I'll get to it in a second. Those are the sub-points. Apologies. But my third and sort of maybe most exciting point or answer to this question, the way that Christian story speaks to this question of God's hiddenness, is the claim that God actually has revealed himself, both consistently and emphatically, through a whole multitude of ways, through the vast majority of the data of human experience that we have to work with. And so I'm actually going to pause there. I'm going to come back to that and share a whole bunch of thoughts around how God might have actually revealed himself consistently and emphatically. But before we do that, I'm going to throw back to Sam, and I think we'll have a bit of time to think, to ask questions, and to have the mains brought out. Is to line up correctly the way that they are. If you're interested in more specifics on this, there's a great Australian scientist called Luke Barnes who's written a lot on this. And actually a lot of this stuff about science that I'm talking about has actually been recently discussed at a really high level on Joe Rogan's podcast by a guy called Stephen Meyer. So feel free to look up that episode just in the last week, I think, if you're interested in that. But to give you some intuition to what to do with those big numbers, imagine this analogy. Imagine I said to you, it's a little bit grim, but imagine I said to you, I've got a gun to your head, and you're blindfolded, and I'm going to pull a ping pong ball, right, out of a big group of ping pong balls, and there's one white one, and all the rest are yellow. Let's start with, say, a London double-decker bus, right? We fill a London double-decker bus inside and out with yellow ping pong balls. We put in one white one. We mix it all up. We send someone in blindfolded randomly to pick a random ball, and if they come out with the orange ball, you die. You get shot, all right? But if they come out with the white ball, you survive. All right, you're fine. We let you go free. All right, you send someone in, do the experiment, and you're waiting there, and you survive. All right, the odds of that happening just by random chance of them pulling out the white ball is 1 in 10 to the power of 6. Okay, let's say we scale up to the size of the Earth. So we hollow it out, we fill the whole Earth with yellow ping pong balls, we put in one white one, mix it around, do the same experiment, and we pull out the white one first time, you survive amazingly, 1 in 10 to the power of 18. Right? We do it with the sun, 1 in 10 to the power of 24. Right? And just one of these constants I was talking about, 1 in 10 to the power of 120. Right? These are the odds. And so the question is, if our universe is that seemingly finely tuned for intelligent life, the sort of only three live explanations that we have on offer, according to philosophers, are physical necessity. It just has to be this way for some reason. And that's been almost universally rejected. There's no real reason to think that these have to be the way that they are. Chance, it's just luck, basically, or design. There's some sort of design behind it. Fred Hoyle, one of the famous sort of stubbornly atheistic philosophers for a long time, kind of became a theist, a believer in God, towards the end of his life, because he said that it really looks like some sort of super intellect has monkeyed with physics when he discovered these constants and quantities. And so I think about you're the person in that position and you survive. Say we have to pull it out of the sun 10 times in a row, white ball every time, randomly, for you to survive. And you do, what's the most logical explanation? That you just randomly out of luck survived, or that there's some sort of agents, there's some sort of intelligence that's rigged this game on your behalf? There's some sort of intellect, there's some sort of design that's involved. That's the Christian influence from the fine-tuning in the universe. Some of these other ones, so like abiogenesis, that just means the origin of life out of nothing, as far as I'm aware, and I think this is not a particularly controversial opinion. Modern science has almost no explanation of how inorganic chemistry can produce the origins of life out of nothing. DNA, the evidence in DNA, again, Francis Collins of the Human Genome Project speaks a lot about this in his book, The Language of God. He's the head of the Human Genome Project in the US and a Christian. Because of this evidence in DNA, Anthony Flew, one of the most famous atheists of the last century, became a believer in some sort of God towards the end of his life because of the evidence in the information code of DNA that looks remarkably like language. I think an analogy that's often given is if you see alphabet cereal, you come down in the morning to breakfast. I don't know if anyone actually eats alphabet cereal, but you see it on the table spelled out in alphabet cereal. Hi, Josh, please take the bins out and do the washing up today. See you tonight. Lots of love from Emma, right? Is the most likely explanation, would I infer, just intuitively seeing that someone's randomly knocked over the thing and it's just fallen that way, or that there's some sort of design behind it? And similarly, when we look at the complexity of the genetic information in DNA, it's far more complex than that message. And many people have changed their mind on their whole worldview because of the way that points to design. Stephen Meyer, I was going to say, in that Joe Rogan podcast, this is his area of expertise, and he speaks at length on that one about this evidence in DNA. And the last one that I put up there, I think, was just mathematics. Just the fact that maths works and it describes the physical universe has been described as the problem of the unreasonable applicability of mathematics to the natural sciences. And you can read plenty more on that. It's been often said, it's kind of a paraphrase-ish of Einstein, that the most incomprehensible thing about our universe is that it's comprehensible. One of the strangest things about our world, particularly from a naturalistic or an atheistic worldview, is that we can make sense of the world around us, that it's ordered, that it's not just random, and that mathematics, which is kind of an abstract, non-physical thing, describes the universe in such intimate and specific and beautiful ways. So that's a bunch of stuff from Heavens. I know I'm sort of flying over a whole range of different ideas, but the idea is kind of to whet your appetite about how the vast majority of the data of human experience from so many different avenues, I think in a cumulative case, points towards the likelihood of God's existence as the best explanation. And this kind of builds, obviously we don't get to Christianity and to Jesus in one jump, but a big cumulative case to think that actually this is very plausible. The second, though, is actually humanity. So not just the world around us, but the world within us. And I actually think that in many ways, the best argument for God's existence is watching me with your eyes, listening to me with your ears, sitting in your chair right now. The way the Bible sets it up in Genesis 1:27 says, so God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Romans 2:15 says, they, and it's speaking of non-Jewish believers, Gentiles, so people in the Old Testament who didn't even have God's special and direct revelation, they show that the requirements of the law are written on their hearts, their consciences also bearing witness, and their thoughts sometimes accusing them, and at other times even defending them. So this idea that all people everywhere have access to a conscience that points them to the objectivity, the realness of certain rights and wrongs that's designed to point them towards God. And so whether we think from our experience of consciousness, what's called in psychology the hard problem of consciousness, how do we explain this phenomenon of consciousness that we have in purely material terms, to free will, which many people who don't believe in any sort of God materialists really are forced to dispose of and to resort to some sort of determinism that we don't have any free will. Those things are very difficult to explain in purely material terms, or to our deepest desires for meaning and purpose, our greatest convictions of conscience, that from human rights on the one hand to rape and racism, some things are really right and others are really wrong, independent of what the majority of people at any given time believe about them. It's not just majority opinion, it's not just socially subjective. These things are really right and really wrong in an objective sense, not just culturally contingent preferences like food and clothing. That all human beings have an inalienable dignity and intrinsic moral value that's deserving of all provision and protection. I think deep down we have this sense that morality is objective. It's not just subjective. But why would that be true without any sort of God? On a secular humanist story, if we're just the spin-offs of blind evolutionary processes, if we're just accidental byproducts of blind physical forces, molecules in motion without any difference fundamentally to ants or to dirt, how would we account for these radical claims that deep down we know to be true? And some of these intuitions I've described have been formalized into philosophical arguments, but I'm just trying to give you some of the intuition behind so much of our human experience that I think points beyond ourselves and beyond a material world to something beyond it. So for the sake of time, I'm just scratching the surface here, but when I look at God's consistent self-revelation in creation, at the end of the day, it's a bit of a cute tagline, but I would say I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. What's incredible, though, for the Christian, and I think here one of the things that really sets Christianity, the Jesus movement, apart from every other world religion, is the scandalous claim that not only has God revealed himself consistently in general revelation, in creation, in conscience, in the heavens, in humanity, in data that's available to everyone everywhere at every time, but that God has also revealed himself emphatically in history and ultimately through the person of Jesus, who clothed himself in flesh and blood and came to dwell amongst us, the invisible God made visible, prepared for by providence and predicted by prophecy for thousands of years. Jesus's perfect life, his sacrificial death, his triumphant resurrection, I would argue have left a God-shaped hole in history that even secular scholars will acknowledge cries out for explanation in so many ways. And so in my last couple of minutes, let me give you just two ways. Number one, the facts surrounding Jesus's resurrection, right? These cry out for explanation. And this is one of the biggest things that persuaded me as a high school student, that God was real and that Jesus was who he said he was. And so let's focus on just three facts that actually I was stunned to discover the vast majority of scholars agree on, Christians and non-Christians alike. Right, so secular scholars, atheists, agnostics agree on these facts surrounding Jesus' resurrection. Number one, here's a bunch of sort of general stuff from history, but I'm going to talk specifically about the resurrection. That Jesus' tomb was found empty by a group of his women followers early on Sunday morning. Right? And I'll tell you the reason why even non-Christian scholars agree with this is because we have so much attestation for it early and simple. It's not radically embellished, but we have multiple independent sources that testify to this fact, right? A lot of events in the ancient world rest on one source. Two is great a lot of the time. Bart Ehrman, who's a skeptical scholar, in his book lists 11 independent sources for the crucifixion of Jesus. That's not for the empty tomb, but there's still plenty for that as well. But 11 independent sources. And he says to people who don't believe Jesus existed or that he didn't die, how do you deal with 11 independent sources if you're just doing normal history? This is not even all Christian sources, Roman sources, Jewish sources, etc. So the testimony is early and simple to the empty tomb. It's primarily based on the testimony of women, which was worth almost nothing at the time in a court of law. And so if the disciples are making this story up later, that's an incredibly embarrassing and inconvenient way to start their conspiracy, right? But really speaks, as a historian, as we look back on it, to why would they do that unless that was genuinely what happened? And thirdly, it's acknowledged by the Sanhedrin, which is sort of the Jewish authority. So even the early opposition to Jesus, their explanation that we have recorded is, oh, the disciples stole the body, which again acknowledges that the tomb is empty, right? They wouldn't say that if they could be like, here's the body, it's in the tomb. And so I'm going to read you a quote. This is by a secular scholar. He's not a Christian. D.H. Van Dalen, leader in the field. He says, it is extremely difficult to object to the early tomb on historical grounds. Those who deny it do so on the basis of theological or philosophical assumptions. Right? All right. So that's one, empty tomb. Number two, what we're calling the post-mortem appearances. That just means the appearances of Jesus to people after he died, to many individuals and groups at different places and times, even including Jesus' skeptics and enemies, right? Like his brother James, like the apostle Paul. So we're not claiming that they necessarily had the exact experience that they described, but these scholars will concede, like even the atheist Gerd Ludemann, he concludes this, it may be taken as historically certain that Peter and the disciples had experiences after Jesus' death in which Jesus appeared to them as the risen Christ. So these secular scholars are obviously not agreeing that the experiences were correct, that they were rightly interpreted, but they're saying these guys had some sort of experiences that you have to explain. That's a fact. And thirdly, the origin of the disciples' faith, that Jesus' original disciples came to genuinely and sincerely believe that God had raised Jesus from the dead despite every predisposition to the contrary. And what I mean by that is this belief for them produced a radical degree of transformation in their personal lives, from people who were cowering, running from the crucifixion, in total defeat of their movement, to people who were emboldened and willing to speak out with incredible courage for their faith, people who were willing to die and endure intense persecution for something that they would have known to be false if it was, which is different to people all around the world who might die for ideologies that are false, but at least they believe to be true. These guys would have known that what they were dying for was a lie and that they weren't gaining anything from it. And thirdly, this was an incredibly un-Jewish belief, right? Obviously, the Pharisees and the Sadducees at the time debated even whether there was any resurrection from the dead. But even those who believed in one believed that it was something that came at the end of history and for all people generally, not for unique individuals in the middle of history. The belief in a dying and rising Messiah was not part of the Jewish understanding at the time. And so this origin of the disciples' faith they came up with was something that was fundamentally un-Jewish and wasn't coming from the background of their cultural understanding at the time. Bart Ehrman says this. He says it is, again, another very skeptical non-Christian scholar. He says it is a historical fact that some of Jesus' followers came to believe that he had been raised from the dead soon after his execution. We know some of these believers by name. One of them, the Apostle Paul, claims quite plainly to have seen Jesus alive after his death. And so the question that arises is, how do we best explain these three facts? Right? These are the facts that we have on the table that even secular scholars, the vast majority of them, agree on. How do we best explain them? And here are a couple of the most common and strongest alternative theories, right? So I've tried to keep things in triplets to make it easier to think about, easier to remember. Three facts, three sort of alternative explanations. One, Jesus didn't really die on the cross, is kind of called swoon theory. Sometimes, oh, he maybe just sort of went into a coma and then, you know, later he came back to life and that explains it. Well, we have plenty of extra evidence outside the Bible that Romans had never messed up an execution like this, right? We have very comprehensive evidence that never really happened. And they had good reason not to, because if they did, often the guards and their families would be crucified as a result, right? So it's a pretty good incentive not to. We've got the spear into Jesus' side with water coming out, which is what you'd expect from a dead body with the blood and water separating. And yet the medicine to understand that is only like 100 years old. So this is recorded before they would have known that that's a direct sign of saying that. It's just reporting what happened. And we just have these accounts that, you know, Jesus' skin hung like ribbons from his back. Nails are driven through his hands. He's hanging for 6 hours. A spear's driven through his side. But then maybe he doesn't die and he gets buried. And then 2 days later, he's sort of up and at him, rolling away the stone, fighting off Roman guards, jogging 7 miles to Emmaus. Like, after being crucified. Like, have you ever broken a toe and tried to just walk like across the room without looking like your hips have exploded inside of your pelvis? Like, to think that Jesus could have sustained these kinds of injuries and then convinced his disciples that he'd victoriously risen from the dead, I think is a pretty ridiculous theory and is dismissed as such by many. Second one, deception. So the idea that, you know, someone switched for Jesus or the disciples stole the body. The problem with this is, again, as I mentioned, these inconvenient truths around the women as the first eyewitnesses, the fact that disciples make themselves look like idiots throughout a lot of these accounts, the idea that, as I mentioned before, people don't die for something that they know to be a lie and gain nothing from, right? Think of famous historical scandals like Watergate, where if you have enough people in on a conspiracy like this, at the end of the day, a little bit of pressure and people will crack and someone will flip and reveal the truth. As far as we know, all of these disciples who would have been in on this crazy conspiracy gained nothing but persecution throughout their lives, were tortured and persecuted and died for this, which seems pretty strange. Also, the third one is delusion, right? That there were some sort of hallucinations that explain these disciples' experiences. But as far as we know, according to contemporary medical evidence, we don't know really of any phenomenon that allows for sort of group delusions, right? When people hallucinate, they don't, you know, 30 people don't see the same identical hallucination at the same time. It's not really how that works. And there's different scientific and psychological associations on the record on that. This doesn't explain the belief in a bodily resurrection. So if they had some sort of hallucinations, given their Jewish background, the most likely conclusion that disciples would have come to is that Jesus had been raised spiritually in some sense from the dead, but it wouldn't give them any confidence in a tangible physical resurrection, which is what they proclaimed and were willing to die for. And thirdly, this doesn't explain the empty tomb. So it doesn't even explain all the facts. You've got to start then layering theories on top of each other, which becomes increasingly implausible. And so I genuinely think that despite the fact that it requires you to believe a miracle, the best explanation for these facts that everyone agrees on is the one that the original disciples gave, that God raised Jesus from the dead. And if you ask a lot of leading secular scholars who I've quoted, like agreeing with these facts, you know, what's their explanation? A lot of them just won't give one. A lot of them will say, as a historian, I'm not interested in that question. Or they'll say it's impossible for history to prove a miracle. Or they trot out David Hume's argument against miracles that any appeal to miracle is inherently more improbable than any other that it's basically impossible to establish a miracle based on any evidence. We could go into the philosophical problems with that, but we won't for time. But I think the point is, there is actually a really robust historical case to be made for Jesus's resurrection, which demonstrates his divinity, God's vindication of him, and that life after death and immortality is available, not only for Jesus, but for those who are in him as well. The second and last one I'll sort of say in terms of God's emphatic influence on history is the defining influence of the Jesus movement. And this is sort of just the idea that the way that we think today, so many of the truths that we assume to be self-evident, so many of the values that we take for granted as universally obvious, are actually largely foreign to the ancient world and are peculiar instead to the cataclysmic historical influence of Jesus and the early church. Values like science, freedom, progress, equality, right? That may sound really ambitious and controversial to claim that, but if you're interested in more, let me point you to just two recent books that have made that case really well. One is called Dominion by a guy called Tom Holland. He's not a Christian, right? So he doesn't believe in God, doesn't believe in Jesus, but this is his assessment of history as a professional historian. And another one is called The Air We Breathe by Glenn Scrivener, probably shorter and more accessible. He is a Christian, and he makes a really strong case for how the Christian Revolution changed the world. And I think that's a way that God has kind of revealed himself to us as well. So having said all of that, let me finish with this invitation from the mouth of Jesus in Matthew 7:7. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. This welcome is nothing new, right? From passages like Deuteronomy 4 in the Old Testament to Jeremiah 29 and then from the call to come from death to life, to embrace the kingdom of God, closing out some of the Bible's last words in the book of Revelation. God consistently promises that he will be found in time by all who seek him with an open mind and an open heart. Just over a week ago, I was fortunate enough to be in Athens, sitting on the Areopagus Hill where just under 2,000 years ago, Paul explained to the gathering crowds. He said this: "The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by human hands. And he's not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. From one man, he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth." And here's what he says: "And he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being." And so ultimately I would say God is not far from any one of us. He created us with the purpose of knowing him personally, and he is working sovereignly according to his wisdom throughout all of history to reveal himself to people in the right ways, at the right times, so as to save as many as possible, regardless of how often we choose to stick our heads in the sand. And we may not always understand his methods or his timing. They might seem mysterious to us, but when we take a step back, there's nothing about that that's particularly surprising. In fact, when we consider how limited our perspective is in time and space compared with God's wisdom, that's exactly what we might expect. So if you're here tonight, you don't know Jesus and the life that he brings, my invitation to you is simple: to seek God with everything you have, because if the Christian message is true, then it's the greatest news in the history of the world, and nothing else matters except gaining eternal life in a relationship with Jesus. God promises that if you would read the Bible for yourself and cry out to him, that he will reveal himself to you in his time. And so why not take him up on that challenge? Like, what do you have to lose? The only tragedy would be if you never gave yourself enough time to look. So it's time to stop counting and to start seeking. And if you're already a Christian, my takeaway for you is twofold. One, for those who even as Christians might be feeling a sense of God's profound absence in this or other seasons of life, I hope that some of these thoughts have strengthened your assurance and helped to make sense of your experience and encourage you to persevere. There's a really great Footsteps poem that many of you'd be aware of that's, I think, really emotionally encouraging. You could Google Footsteps poem on that. But James 4 promises us that if we draw near to the Lord, he will draw near to us. But secondly, it's a challenge to think about how you could be prepared to give an answer to those who ask you for the reason for the hope that you have, as Peter commands us in 1 Peter 3. So that next time a skeptical friend suggests that there's no evidence to believe in God, that you might have one or two more thoughts, not everything I've said, but just one or two more thoughts that you remember or you go and look up later that you might be able to have to get the conversation going. My prayer is that you would be inspired to know Jesus better and to be better equipped to make him known. Thanks. I hand over to Sam.
Awesome. There's a lot of the really interesting thoughts that Josh has given, and like he said, got to move quickly because there's so many topics that's just scratching the ice on. And really, if you want to dig into them, we encourage you to dig into them. I love the saying, "Doubt your doubts." And don't stay in a place of doubt. If you have these questions, there's answers out there. And to do the right thing intellectually and engage in those. Talk to people, engage. There's a whole realm of people who are intellectually engaging in this space. And so we'd love to encourage you to explore your faith and grow it deeper. Awesome. Well, we're going to do dessert now. Who's ready for some dessert? Yeah, woo! All right, so we're going to do some dessert. So we're going to clear out the food. If you've got some more questions, feel free to text me. You've got a couple of questions. We're going to do a short Q&A straight after this little break.